You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 140.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. Well, that was a teaser from the song From the Beginning by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I thought that was very appropriate considering the recent passing of Keith Emerson. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer was one of my favorite groups from the past. So I was able to get this PodSafe version because it's from a live performance. They did a tour back in 1998. I'll dedicate this podcast to Keith Emerson. So listen to the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all of the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. Today, I have the pleasure of talking with Brian Alexander. He's an educator, futurist, speaker, writer, and senior researcher for the New Media Consortium. I've talked to Brian in the past about his involvement with the New Media Consortium Horizon Report. The 2016 Horizon Report just came out, and so that'll be the main topic of our discussion. I really enjoy speaking with Brian. He really has his finger on the future of education, so I think you'll enjoy it. So without further ado, here's my interview with Brian Alexander. Brian, it's good to talk to you again. I think it was about a year ago when we last talked. I'm always anxious to hear about your take on the future in higher ed.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure. I can't believe time has flown by this quickly. I mean, it's a cliche to say, but it really does feel like we were just talking.
I think that happens the older you get, I've noticed. time seems to go by quicker and quicker. So one thing I, of course, is always good to talk about with you is the Horizon Report, I should say, from the New Media Consortium. I understand you're a senior researcher there, and I always look forward to reading that. Just for my audience, I wonder if you could just briefly review the process, because I think it's very interesting. It's a pretty complex process, and there are a lot of fingers in that. How does that really work?
It is. It's an interesting process, and it's one that's been around for about a half century. I see it in the business world. I see it in the military world and in the governmental world. Haven't seen as much in education. It's called the Delphi method. It's a futuring process whereby you take a group of experts and you try and squeeze out the best understanding they have of the future of their domain. And it doesn't matter what the domain is. It could be, footwear. It could be Icelandic politics. You get experts in a room, and then you work through a process kind of like a focus group. You ask them to determine the most powerful trends, the most powerful forces pushing forward their field. And then you get them to argue about it. And you can prime the pump on this by providing research and questions and prompts. And then they end up with a list. And you get them to rank the list. And you can go through a few different ways of doing this, with votes, with weighted votes, and so on. But the outcome is really expert knowledge and expert assessment of where they think a field is going. Now, that this is usually a face-to-face event. Based on technology, we've been able to take this online. And the Horizon Report does this with about almost 50 experts who are literally around the world, from Southeast Asia, from Europe, from North America. And over a few month period, we're brought together. The technology we use is very basic. We use a wiki. People are nudged by email. And there are a couple of web-based voting tools. But the wiki is the main source. And each wiki page will have questions for us to consider, like, what are the biggest challenges facing the integration of technology and teaching? What are the biggest technologies that we should be considering? That kind of thing. And we'll use the wiki to join together, argue, tease out differences. It's really a delightful process to be part of. It's like a high-level graduate school seminar. It's very challenging, very rich. At the end of it, we have a kind of schematic understanding We have an outline. We have candidates from a poll. And then the New Media Consortium turns this into really good prose. They find examples. They also crowdsource it a bit through the NMC population. They find examples of the different trends and the different technologies, and they frame it out into this report. The report is written in a way to be very, very accessible by anybody in a college campus. It's not aimed at technologists, although technologists read it frequently and with profit. It's aimed at presidents, trustees, librarians, faculty, anybody in a campus or a library or a museum who's interested in the future.
Well, I certainly hope our leadership here reads it. I try to promote it any way I can. And what I thought I would try with you this time, a little different maybe, is to do sort of a lightning round and get your spontaneous comment briefly about some of the technologies that are listed in this year's report. So the first one in the time to adoption horizon of 1 year or less, what would you say, what was the first thing that comes to your mind about bring your own device?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind was, of course, and the 1 year or less technologies, that's where they are. I mean, they're that imminent. But I have to say, BYOD is not, of course, for many campuses. It's still a new idea. In fact, on Monday, we had an event up here in the Northeast. NERCOMP organized a Horizon Report Summit, and we were discussing it. Most campuses involved do not have a BYOD policy. And in fact, several of them had developed virtualization as a kind of antidote to BYOD. So, you know, you can bring your own device. We won't support it. But the goal is so that you can use it to get access to our virtualized lab or virtualized desktop, virtualized apps. So that's a quick answer.
Okay. How about learning analytics and adaptive learning?
Everyone's interested. And by everyone, I mean staff are interested. Providers are interested. People who do assessment in campuses, you know, such as deans for assessment, for example, are only interested. And faculty are intrigued. There's a lot of energy behind this. I would look carefully to learning management systems. Those guys have the best grasp of the data that needs to be fed into learning analytics. Also look for textbook companies, because as their materials get richer and richer, you know, think like My Math Lab, for example, there's more and more data for them to manipulate and more value. If they can actually provide analytics back to faculty and students, that's a real win for them.
Moving on to 2 to 3 years, what about augmented and virtual reality?
Well, if you want me to just give my quick take, both of those are very powerful pedagogically. They kick into a whole bunch of creative impulses. They tie into visualization challenges, which we've known for a long time are critical for learning. Basically, they help you visualize things that you couldn't normally see easily, such as historical sites that no longer exist or scientific matters that we can't see with the naked eye, be they molecules or the inside of this a hurricane. They're both very, very different. I mean, virtual reality involves, you know, creating an artificial version and experiencing it through the technology. Well, augmented reality takes that digital material and pins it to the physical world. So you think if you and I are taking a class on DNA, we might want to strap on Oculus Rift in order to wander through the interior of a DNA molecule. That'd be very exciting. But if we're taking an architecture class, we might want to use augmented reality so that when we explore, say, a Chicago building from the turn of the 20th century, we can summon up documents like building plans and historical commentary that we can attach to the physical environment without altering the physical environment, you know, so that we can put aside our whatever technology we use to see it and experience it by itself without any mediation at all.
As a little aside, I'm reminded of the New York Times experiment recently where they put a Google Cardboard device in the New York Times. I got one, and it's not really augmented or virtual reality. I would say it's more like interactive video. What do you think of that experiment, and do you think that has some traction?
A few things. First, there's a lot of blurs between these categories, and so I think that is interactive video and that is virtual reality. You know, when you experience it with the full Google Cardboard medium, you do blot out the rest of the world and you enter the world of that, which is what we do in cinema, right? But But it is also 3D in that when you turn your head, you get to the African story, for example. You get to look behind you. You get to look to the left, the right. You get to look up and see aircraft going overhead. So I think that was, first of all, a case of the category blurring, which is very interesting. The second was that this was the low-end version. Google Cardboard is extremely affordable, very accessible, very cheap, as opposed to Oculus Rift, which cost as much as a laptop. I mean, that's expensive. And on top of it, the hardware to make Oculus Rift content is extremely rare. Most laptops and desktops can't work with it right now. The computation involved is just enormous. A third thing to think about is the cost of making this content. Now we're back at this is like the mid-20th century capital-intensive media time, where in order to make a TV show, you need a lot of capital. To make a book, you need a publisher, that kind of thing. To actually make 3D video is really capital-intensive. So it's the New York Times who does this, and they spend a lot of money and a lot of time doing it. So it's going to take some time for that to come down to where just the average student or the average professor can make 3D content.
Well, one way to maybe make some devices is makerspaces. What do you say about makerspaces?
Makerspaces have all kinds of things. So just keep in mind, when we say makerspaces, we really kind of mean makerspaces plus 3D printing. The two are really combined. One terrific advantage of 3D of makerspaces is that they have this. They really do have guide on the side pedagogy. Really, lots of peer-based learning, which is just terrific. A second thing that's great is if anybody is concerned about people in your community who are too digital. You know, if we have, say, the Sherry Turkle, Nicholas Carr people who think that the digital environment is de-skilling us from face-to-face communications, then the makerspaces are a great way to get away from that. I mean, they're not Luddite spaces. They use computers, but they're privileging face-to-face, immediate, tactile, analog interaction. And the third thing that's so excellent, Ryan, tell them where do you live?
In Philadelphia.
Great example. All right. In Philadelphia, you've got a number of people who live there who are, I think of them as Rust Belt refugees. They worked in factories in the late 20th century, and a lot of their skills are no longer relevant. I mean, you can use the skills, they just don't have any place to employ them. People who work with metal, who work with diesel, who work with plastics. And you think about as well in some older communities where you have people who have practical knowledge going back to the 1930s, everything from canning to working with fabrics. Well, you can connect your school makerspace with the community that way. What a win. You get to bring in the community. You get to help transmit knowledge that is not often talked about. What a great experience for an 18-year-old, and what a great experience for the faculty and staff.
Moving on to a 4 to 5 year horizon, what do you say about effective computing?
I want you to think about, just as an extreme case, the possibility that we will reach a point where computers, specifically with some form of physical presence, be it a robot or something smaller, will be able to analyze and respond to humans at an emotional level. As you think about the ability for technology to perceive, say, eyeball dilation, pupil dilation, skin, blood flow to the skin, where a computer can look at you and get a sense of if you're angry or embarrassed or happy or tired. And we have to think down the road a bit. Will we reach a point where the technology will be as good as the average person at detecting emotional input? This is an exciting thing to think about. Well, we can think about this in a lot of ways. I mean, one is, if we are concerned about student retention, and we really are, and if we're concerned about student completion, being able to get a better handle on students' emotional status in order to stage an intervention at the counseling level, at the advising level, simply the classroom level, is a real win that could really help. And it might be that this happens through data, where we're able to sift through data of how a student interacts with e-reserves, with discussion boards or whatever, and we're able to get a sense of when they have a problem, and maybe we can help. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And a lot of problems, too, of course.
Yeah. Some people are going to think it's creepy.
Yeah.
But I can see, a lot of, value add to a lot of the things we do in video. I always like to bring up ApprendNet, which is one of my favorite educational applications, which depends totally on video, presenting a case in video, and then the student presents their response in video. And I could imagine effective computing, looking at facial expression and just you know, adding some analytics in there from studying the person's face.
Well, absolutely. In fact, there's already software, that proctoring software, that takes a look at the human face when you're, you know, when you're taking an exam, you're at the keyboard and you're typing away, and it looks at micro expressions in your face and it looks at where you're going. Now, for example, people who are cheating are going to tend to look left and right. You know, and you can follow their voice. You know, if you're taking an exam, you're probably going to be quiet. But if you're trying to whisper something, you know, hey, what's the answer number 7? you can pitch that, and the software is there to analyze this and look for it, so it can automate that. Increasingly, it's a cliche to say, increasingly the digital world is more and more imminent to the human experience. It's more and more occupying a greater place within our emotional and intimate spaces. We should just expect to see more emotional computing involved.
You already mentioned it, but robotics is the last on my list. And I'll tell you, just today, I saw a demo of, you know, Boston Dynamics, which is known for, you know, the military robots. But they have a bipedal robot now that is amazing. By itself, can walk down the street, open doors, be pushed and get up. And it's truly amazing. How do you see robotics fitting into higher ed?
That's an extraordinary video, and I recommend everyone watch it if they haven't seen it yet. Especially, I would recommend watching it and halfway through, do a gut check on your emotional response. The first third of it has this robot doing stuff, and then the middle third has the robot being tormented by a human. So just get a sense of your immediate emotional response. Do you identify with the robot? You know, do you begin to anthropomorphize it? It's fascinating. We can mention this in a few ways. Okay, one thing that happens in education is that we already have classes that teach robotics. I mean, you think about Lego Mindstorms, for example, which is just fabulous, or the growing deployment of Arduino, right? Well, this is something which we should expect to see grow still further, in part because it's fascinating, it's a great field of intellectual inquiry, but also because the technology is getting more and more powerful, and because it's playing a larger and larger role in the world. We're seeing robots play a role in very dangerous situations, be it the Fukushima reactor or bomb disposal. I've been reading this heartbreaking book on Chernobyl right now, and one of my thoughts is, my God, the Soviets threw so many people into the heart of the reactor to stop it. What if we had bots? What a great win. Well, let's turn to self-driving cars. The clincher for the self-driving car deal is not cost savings or comfort. It's that they can keep us from killing 30,000 people a year on the roads. What a tremendous, tremendous thing that would be. So I think academically, we have a lot at stake at doing more with robots. At the same time, we have to think about ways in which we can use robots in the classroom or for learning. So have you looked at any of what I call doppelbots or telepresence robots?
Yes. I saw a very primitive one. Was basically a stick with an iPad in front,
right,
and could move around the room and converse with people.
Exactly. And there are several different providers that do this. They're quite interesting. I'm waiting to see them be made available by conference centers or by schools, you know, for people who can't make it there physically. It's an upgrade on video conferencing.
Right.
I mean, so that's a step. But let's see how much further we can go. I mean, when you think about study abroad, when you think about interacting with remote labs, how much further will we be able to go in terms of telepresence robotics? And on top of that, to what extent will we see robots playing a role in the whole armature of teaching and learning? For example, will we have a robot docent at a museum that can go, you know, along with you if they don't have a human involved? What extent can we have robot teachers? To what extent can we have robot support staff? These questions would have been ludicrous or simply science fiction 5 years ago. We're looking really hard at those right now. And then, again, this is on the 4 to 5 year horizon out. Take a look. You know, let's just imagine where, if we assume Moore's law doesn't cough and die in the next 5 years, if robotics keeps growing, let's just imagine where these robots can be. That's something to really think hard about.
It's funny you mentioned about identifying with that Boston Dynamics robot. I'm also reminded when you talk about the simple, you know, iPad on a stick, so to speak. I'm reminded of the Good Wife episode where there was this poor teleconferencing robot sort of walking around the office, and everybody was sort of annoyed by it and kept ignoring it and pushing it aside.
Yeah, it showed up in The Good Wife. It showed up in what's it called? Not the IT Crowd, but the other another TV show with geeks and nerds in it. I forget which one it is. In fact, I've experienced this. I mean, when I've driven around the what I call a doppelbot, I've run into problems. Once a friend of mine, in a jovial mood, picked up the robot and held it over his head. You know, that was a wild experience. But there's also the creepy side. There's something weirdly uncanny about a robot that speaks the voice of a person. I mean, if you go back 120 years ago, if you look at the gramophone, that creeped out people all over the place, because for the first time in human history, you could literally hear the voice of the dead. Oh my gosh, that's a terrifying thing. And if you think back to the Twilight Zone, you can think about several creepy episodes involving the telephone, right? Or think about whenever we come up with a new medium, we make it creepy. But at the same time, it's so accessible. And this is just what we have right now. I mean, again, what we can do in 4 or 5 years. Think, for example, about drones. When they're remotely operated, they're a form of a telepresence robot. When they're autonomous, they're an autonomous robot. And right now, we are having serious international policy discussions about who is responsible when a robot hurts somebody or kills somebody.
Right, like the self-driving cars, who's the driver?
Well, yeah. They've tentatively decided that the software is the driver. Okay, so when one of these hurts and kills somebody, how do you do insurance for this? How do you do claims? Who is right? And of course, we have this in war right now. When predator drones kill the wrong person, who's at fault? Is it the programmer? Is it the military unit? I mean, again, these were great science fiction questions. But, the robot idea isn't that old. It's only about 110 years old. The word itself comes from the Czech, and it basically means worker. Now we have these workers. Again, that's what the Horizon Report does, is we look a little bit ahead to see what's coming down the pike, and I would watch for those robots.
Yep. Speaking of the Horizon Report again, since I have been following it over a number of years, I've often wondered how consistent or how accurate their predictions are if you compare 1 year to the next, and you see a term sort of, let's say, just limit it to the technology. Technology is sort of appearing and disappearing and coming back again and sure. Under different time horizons. Has anybody studied out of curiosity, really, to see how consistent that is?
No, it's a great thing to do. And in fact, in future studies, this is considered good practice that anybody who does forecasting should look back and see what they did wrong, what they got right, and what you can learn from it, what blind spots. I mean, personally, I'm very proud of two horrible things I got badly wrong. In 2008, I predicted, and this sounds embarrassing now, I predicted that we would see a lot of intercampus collaboration and that we would see campus athletics cut or trimmed back. Both of these were wrong. And for me, I learned that I had woefully underestimated the irrational, I don't mean that as a criticism, I mean the non-economic support for college athletics. And I had underestimated the obstacles to intercampus collaboration. So when I look at the Horizon Report, I haven't done this except in an informal ad hoc basis. I'm kind of grimly proud that I was very, very skeptical of Second Life from the beginning. And that was something which was predicted to go places, and virtual worlds did not, except for gaming, which is a different thing. Audrey Waters and Ruben Puente Dura have each done some research looking back over previous Horizon reports. So if you just Google their names and the phrase Horizon Report, you should be able to pull up pages. I think Audrey actually has a domain about this. But it's important to look back and see, what you got right, what that tells you, in order to become a better forecaster, in order to sharpen your gaze ahead. I'm excited to do that.
Speaking of future, I know you're all about the future. I know you. Bertie told me that you have something called the Future Trends Forum. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
I'd be glad to. I've been for almost 5 years now. I've been doing a monthly report called Future Trends in Technology and Education. The domain for that is ftte.us. It's a monthly report. We look at current trends to see what they can tell us about the future. So I built on this a video series, which we're in the third week of right now. Using the Shindig video platform, we have a weekly discussion, me and some extraordinary person, a visionary, a practitioner, an inventor, and we talk about their take on the future of education and technology. So our first week, we had, again, Audrey Waters, who gave a very, very powerful discussion about venture capital and about the history of technology and teaching. Last week, we had Richard DeMillo from Georgia Tech, that university, Center for 21st Century Universities, authored several very provocative books. And he gave some really, really interesting thoughts about where universities are going, looking at the maturation of MOOCs, looking at a wide variety of trends. Tomorrow afternoon, we have Casey Green, who is the creator and author of the Campus Computing Project, which is the best data source for information about how campuses actually use technology. So we're going to interrogate him about that and about a new report he just authored about faculty attitudes towards digital technology to get a sense of where these trends are going down the road, what's happening with everything from security to LMSs to staff development to how come faculty haven't embraced e-textbooks, that kind of thing. We have a whole stack of speakers coming up for the next 10 weeks.
Well, that sounds great. I'm definitely going to sign in. And I assume if folks miss the actual event, because this is a live event, you also have recordings?
I do. In fact, we have one up right now with Audrey Waters. I just turned my head to look at the upload speed for last week's great big honking file, 8 gig. But we published the entire hour up to YouTube, and it's there, including, and then I published along with that a blog post, which includes my notes and comments from other people. So that's there and accessible, from here on out. So that's an archive ready for people to dive into.
That's great. That's great. I'll tell you, it's such a pleasure talking to you, and we'll have to keep this going. You have a wealth of information and insight into all of this, and I think it's really great. I want to support you any way I can.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you. You're a terrific company, an awfully bright and well-informed guy, and I appreciate the chance to seize control of your desktop.
Thanks again, Brian.
Okay, well, take care.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Make sure to download the Horizon Report. Links to the report and other links to things we discuss are in my show notes. So stay tuned for From the Beginning by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Until next time, have a great week. Doesn't matter at all. There it is.
that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.